Welcome. It is, as always, good to be together. Let me go ahead and dismiss any young ones who can fit into those tiny chairs. You are dismissed, released, free. For the rest of us today, we are, unlike last week, we are turning our attention back to the Jesus backstory, back to the first five books of our Bibles, back to what we call the Pentateuch, back to what in Judaism is called the Torah that is the Jesus backstory. Jesus himself speaking of the Torah, it's recorded in Matthew 5 and 17. Jesus says, "Do not think I have come to abolish the Torah or the Nevi'im." He says, "I have not come to abolish them. I have not come to do away with the Torah. I have not come to do away with the Nevi'im, the prophets." He says, I've come to fulfill. Jesus being the fulfillment of the whole of the Torah, noting the Torah is divided into 54 parshiot, parshiot being the plural of parsha, parsha meaning section or portion. And so as we have been, we are working our way through the Torah, taking it parsha by parsha. And today we pick it up in the second book, what in Hebrew is called Sefer Shmot, translates as the Book of Names. And with that, today we come to Parsha Truma. Parsha Truma travels from Exodus 25 and 1 all the way through to 27 and 19. If you are grabbing a Pew Bible or would like to grab a Pew Bible, page 58 will be helpful. The words will be on this screen behind me. 25 and verse 1 actually begins with, we read the Lord, that's Yahweh in Hebrew. The Lord, Yahweh, said to Moses, verse 2, Daber el b'nei Yisrael, tell the Israelites, Ve'ikuli, to bring me Terumah, an offering. And that's where we get the name for our Parsha. You are to, it says, receive the offering, HaTerumah, for me. And then we read from everyone whose heart prompts them to give. We could say meaning those whose hearts are bent toward generosity. Generosity being the act of giving both freely and abundantly. From everyone whose heart prompts them to give. And this is the offering, HaTerumah. You are to receive from them. It says gold, silver, and bronze, blue, purple, and scarlet yarn, and fine linen, goat hair, ram skins dyed red and another type of durable leather, acacia wood, olive oil for the light, spices for the anointing oil and for the fragrant incense, onyx stones and other gems to be mounted on the, in Hebrew it's ephod, and breastpiece. And so each heart turned toward generosity, each one giving of them of themselves. And then dropping down to verse 8, then have them, we could say all together, create a mikdash. Mikdash is a sanctuary. Create a sanctuary. And a sanctuary can be translated a sacred place or a holy space for me, and so that I, Yahweh, may dwell among them. In effect, the whole purpose, God says, is so that I may be with you. The whole purpose is so that I may be with you. Meaning, in effect, give yourselves, because it is there I will dwell. And then verse 9, make this tabernacle, Mishkan in Hebrew, and all its furnishings exactly like the pattern I will show you. And for the rest of the Parsha, that is exactly what happens. In fact, the rest of the Parsha on one level is overwhelmingly specific, intricate, detailed. We could say it is a rather tedious and exhausting description of the building of the Mishkan. And yet underneath, there are layers and layers of meaning. One of the most probably well-known documented understandings connects the building of the Mishkan to the story of creation. From the Midrash Tanhuma, we read in part, "The tabernacle is equal to the creation of the world itself. Concerning the first day, it is written, 'In the beginning, God created the heaven and the earth,' and it is written elsewhere, 'Who stretched out the heavens like a curtain?' And concerning the tabernacle, it is written, 'And thou shalt make curtains of goat's hair.' About the second day, it states, 'Let there be a firmament and divide between them, and let it divide the waters from the waters.' About the tabernacle, it is written, 'And the veil shall divide between you.' With regard to the third day, it states, 'Let the waters under the heavens be gathered.' With reference to the tabernacle, it is written, 'Thou shalt also make a laver of brass, and thou shalt put water therein.'" This midrash goes on and on through each of the days in quite some depth, and then kind of wraps up around the seventh day, where we read, "The seventh day, the heaven and earth were finished. With regard to the tabernacle, it is written, 'Thus was completed all the work of the tabernacle.' Concerning the creation of the world, it is written, 'And God blessed them,' and of the tabernacle it is said, 'And Moses blessed them.' With regard to the creation, it is said, 'And God finished,' and of the tabernacle it is written, 'On that day Moses made an end.' Of creation it says, 'And hallowed it,' and of the tabernacle, 'And had anointed it and sanctified it.'" Now from there, from this kind of idea of this connection between the Mishkan and the story of creation, we can perhaps even go to a bit of another level, maybe make at least another connection, if not a deeper connection. This one I find rather fascinating. I would also say it's perhaps a bit fantastical, in that it's kind of like, that's an interesting perspective. Well, I can see it, but really, that's, well, not just coincidence, but okay. And so in a sense, it becomes rather intriguing. This is an idea a number of Jewish scholars have proposed, pointing out that in the midst of the detail, verse after verse of very specific instruction, that if we were to kind of sketch it out, and then we were to take kind of a bird's eye view and kind of look down on the schematic, we would see this picture or image begin to appear. Interesting, it begins, as we read in Parshat Truma, Exodus 25 and 10, the first thing we read about is the Ark. Gavron in Hebrew, it's where the tablets were kept. We then read about a Shulchan, what is a table. In this case, it's a table of bread. There's also a menorah, would be a lampstand or a candelabrum. Along with that, there's a small altar. It's called the golden altar of incense. It's where the incense is burned. And then there's a larger altar on which animal offerings are made, the altar of burnt sacrifices. And by way of bird's eye view then, the Mishkan, the tabernacle, it's this kind of large rectangular shape enclosure. The upper area is enclosed in a tent divided into kind of two rooms. And at the top, or in the upper room, in the, we could say maybe the back room, in what is called the Holy of Holies, Kadesh HaKodeshim, and separated then from the rest of the Mishkan with a curtain, it's there we find the Ark, the Aron, again containing the two tablets, the commandments, the mitzvot. Right? And it's there that the commandments are kept. Next, in the lower room or front room, we find the menorah, we find the shulchan, we find the small altar, the golden altar. And then outside of that, in the courtyard, is where we come to kind of the main altar, the altar of burnt offerings. It's where the sacrifices, animal sacrifices, are made. Now, this is where I think it gets a bit interesting and where Jewish scholarship kind of leans into this, especially when we kind of look closely, noting the Aron is located where the brain would be. Right? And in the Ark, again, we have the commandments, right? We have the mitzvot. And in essence, everything flows from the mitzvot. Everything flows from the commandments. Everything flows from the Aron, from Rabbi Jeff Kirschblum. Says this represented the brain, for that was the place where intellectual functions were focused. Just as a brain has two hemispheres, the right and the left, so too there were two tablets. Just as one contemplates Torah, so too the Ark contained the essence of Torah. Rabbi David Foreman, he adds, right up here at the top, that's where the brain would be, and of course, what is in the Ark, it is the two tablets of the law, and how do we relate to that? Well, we relate to it cognitively with our brain. Next, we come to the menorah, the lampstand, we come to the shulchan, the table of showbread. And from above, they are kind of side by side, as if they are two eyes. Again, from Rabbi Foreman, he says, think of what function the menorah has, and for that matter, what is on the table. For an entire week, what is on the table does not get consumed. It is just there to look at. It's showbread. And of course, what do you need in order to be able to see anything? You need light provided by the menorah. Of course, the two elements of sight are you need something to look at and you need light by which to see it. The menorah, one of the eyes, as it were, provides the light. The table, the other eye, as it were, provides something to look at. The bread that's on show. Next, we come to the golden altar, the altar of incense, located in the center where we think a nose should be. Now, like most things in life, and most things even within the Torah, there's much debate and discussion as to exactly where the golden altar should be placed. And so, perhaps, there's many that would say it should be up closer to where the curtain is. And so then you get maybe an interesting-looking face. But as Rabbi Foreman puts it, he says, if we continue down in the schematic of the Mishkan, right there in the middle, right where a nose should be, you've got an altar. This is a very small altar, the altar on which incense would be burned. And of course, how do we relate to incense? We smell it. And then finally, just below that, again, we have the much larger altar. And connected to that altar is actually a very long ramp, and this is the altar on which the offerings were made, and as Rabbi Foreman notes, an altar on which offerings are consumed. And he says, and what do we do with the mouth? We consume things. And so, all together, I suppose, maybe a bit of a Rorschach test, we could say this could be a face. Now, what is maybe even more intriguing with this is that at the completion of the building of the Mishkan, there is a blessing that is given. There was a prayer that was given. It's recorded in Numbers chapter 6, verse 22. We read, the Lord, again Yahweh, said to Moses, tell Aaron and his sons, noting it was Aaron and his descendants, his sons, who were the priests in the tabernacle, serving in the tabernacle. Tell Aaron and his sons, this is how you are to bless the Israelites. Say to them, and then here it is, Numbers 6:24. May the Lord bless you and keep you. May the Lord make what? His face. Panav in Hebrew. May the Lord make his face shine upon you and be gracious to you. May the Lord turn his face toward you and give you, it says, shalom. And so not only do we have this layout, but we also have this Aaronic blessing, this priestly blessing that is given. Now, in addition to that, let's not stop quite yet. Maybe it becomes even a little bit more interesting when we recognize that all throughout the Hebrew Scriptures, there are references to seeking the face of God. 100 times we read of these references. We're not going to read 100 of them. But I just want to pick up a couple from 2 Chronicles 7 and 14. If my people who are called by my name will humble themselves and pray and seek my face and turn from their evil ways, then I will hear from heaven and I will forgive their sin and will heal their land. Psalm 24:5, they will receive blessing from the Lord and justice from God their Savior. Such is the generation of those who seek him, who seek your face, God of Jacob. Psalm 27:8, my heart says of you, seek his face. Your face, Lord, I will seek. 1 Chronicles 16:11, look to the Lord and his strength. Seek his face always. All of which I think brings us really full circle back to Parsha Truma. Noting that whatever we might think of this kind of detailed schematic, there really is no doubt that the whole purpose for the tabernacle is to create, we read, a sanctuary so that I may dwell among them. Noting that that can be translated that my presence may be with them. Add to that, in Hebrew, the face of God is actually synonymous with his presence. In fact, that word face can and is at times translated as presence. In fact, in the Jewish Bible, it is translated as presence. All of which I think invites us then to consider, to maybe spend some time in reflection. Is this true for us? In considering that passage from 1 Chronicles, which incidentally I find interesting that Jewish tradition tells us that Ezra the scribe was the author of 1 Chronicles. It's also interesting that it was Ezra the scribe who developed the dividing of the Torah into parshiot. Dividing the Torah into parshiot and so that it would be read, the entire Torah would be read each year. And so we could ask, in light of Ezra the scribe, do we seek the face of God always? In other words, we could say, do we seek the presence of God always? Do we seek the presence of God, the face of God, continuously? Do we at all times, in any and every situation, whatever it is that you are facing today, in every high and every low, we could ask, am I seeking the face of God? Another way to maybe to get at this is to consider the tabernacle. And we could ask there, is my life a sanctuary for the face of God? Is my life a sanctuary? Have them create a mikdash, a sanctuary, a sacred place, a holy space for me so that I may, he says, dwell among them, so that I may be with them. The whole purpose, God says, is so that I may be with you. Is the whole of my life a mikdash for the presence of God? Noting if we jump back to the beginning, Daber al b'nei Yisrael, tell the Israelites, Vayikuli, to bring me terumah, an offering. You are to receive the offering for me from everyone whose heart prompts them. We could say moves them, bends them, it says to give. Meaning again, the posture, the heart bent toward generosity. What is the activity of giving both freely and abundantly? And it's there in that space that we find space for God. It's there in the midst of generosity that has created a space for God. Point being that the very backstory of Jesus from the very beginning is a God whose heart is bent toward dwelling with you and with me. A God who wants to be with you and me. And he says, here is how you create space for my presence. He says, in effect, it is created in the midst of a generous heart. It is created in the midst of a generous life. Which invites us then to reflect again and ask, is my heart, my posture bent toward generosity? Is my heart, my posture bent toward generosity? And we can think of the whole of the life, we can think of our stuff. We can think of our finances. Are we generous? I think of Mark chapter 10 and verse 21. You can read it later on your own. Jesus' encounter with a man. And Jesus says to this man, come follow me. Right? Come be in my presence. And yet he says, first, go and sell everything. Give it to the poor. And then come. First, go have a generous heart. And then come. But maybe not just generosity of stuff and finances, but what about generosity of thought and word and deed? What about a generosity of love and grace and compassion and care and kindness? Is my heart, my posture bent toward generosity? Do I freely embrace the practice of abundant giving? And then to wrap it up, what would it look like today? What would it look like today to build my life that it might be a sanctuary for His presence? What would it look like today to build my life that it might be a sanctuary for His presence? And then how is my heart prompting me to freely and abundantly give? How is my heart prompting me in this moment? How is my heart prompting me this hour, this afternoon, this day, this week, this season? How is my heart prompting me to freely and abundantly give? Tell the Israelites to bring me an offering, to create a holy space so that I may dwell among them.